Shakespeare Theater Association, in my mind, is the world, has been the longest running World Shakespeare Project, because it's the first time that so many artistic leaders have gathered together to support one specific association or gathering of Shakespeareans.
Hello and welcome to The State of Shakespeare. I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And I'm Jim Elliott.
And today we're speaking with Jim Volz. Jim Volz is a professor at Cal State University Fullerton and president of the Consultants for the Arts. Jim is also editor of the Shakespeare Quarto, the official publication of the Shakespeare Theater Association. And Jim is the author of 9 books on the subjects of Shakespeare and working in theater, including the upcoming Shakespeare Around the World and Buffett and the Bard. Hello, Jim.
Hey there. How you doing?
Thanks for joining us on the program.
Really glad to be here. Always happy to talk about Shakespeare at 9:45 in the morning.
I have a question. What exactly is Buffett and the Bard? It sounds like Shakespeare and Margaritaville.
I know. What a silly book. It started when Warren Buffett would help with fundraisers for the Nebraska Shakespeare Festival, which is based in Omaha. And he would come with members of his staff. And they actually did this takeoff on The Wizard of Oz, except Warren Buffett as the wizard only recited Shakespeare words at this fundraiser. And the artistic director and founder of Nebraska Shakespeare Festival said, you know what? There is so much in common in terms of the kind of the warm and witty Buffettisms. And of course, Shakespeare is the bard. He's the guy who's waxed eloquent on everything from politics and philosophy to money matters and everything else. So Cindy Melby Faniff, who is my partner in this book, collected all of the quotes that were of great fun from Warren Buffett, which there are hundreds of fabulous quotes. And then we found, I sat down and researched and found basically the equivalent and or the opposite, whatever would make you laugh or giggle. It's really a coffee table book more than anything else. So Warren Buffett talks about lending money to your friends, and Shakespeare talks about lending money.
That has to be Shylock.
Yeah, exactly. Talks about how money can ruin you, and Shakespeare talks about how, you know, all ways lie open when money comes before.
How are theaters worldwide coping with the financial crisis?
You know, of all the professional theaters in America especially, I think the Shakespeare theaters are the ones who have weathered the storm better than most of the larger League of Resident Theaters or the TCG theaters. And I think it's because we learn as Shakespeareans to be flexible. You know, 433 years of practice we've had doing Shakespeare's work now, so we've kind of got it down. So most of the festivals that I work with, the 200 or so in the United States of America, and there's another couple hundred and around the world, they all seem to be thriving right now, but they've had to be flexible and they've had to be very savvy about their strategic planning.
So Jim Volz, I could characterize you as an optimist about the state of Shakespeare today.
Always an optimist. You know, I'm a big fan of Hamlet, have to be. And of course, there's that great line that says, there is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. And, you know, that's how the world of Shakespeare works. You've got to keep a positive attitude about all this stuff.
So let me, as we approach the fiscal cliff, let me ask you a very wonky question. So many not-for-profit producing organizations rely on corporate and private sponsors. So what is the implication if the tax code is revised to limit deductions for contributions?
Right. Well, you know, we don't have to worry, as Shakespeare said in Cymbeline, you know, the game is up. You know, the game is not up for Shakespeare festivals, because the truth is that the vast majority of people in America don't give money to theaters and to Shakespeare festivals because they get a tax break. The reasons are much more deep and much more profound than getting a minor break on their taxes for their contributions. I mean, they give because they love the work. They love the poignancy of the language. They understand how important it is to their children to study Shakespeare in grade school and high school, and to learn about the world at large and the greatest literary figure in Western civilization. That's why people really give money, because Shakespeare has affected their lives in a positive way, and they hope that it'll affect the lives of their children and their children's children. So
you've just recently finished a world tour of Shakespeare festivals. Is there anything that you care to share in terms of discoveries or any trends that you've noticed around the world in terms of Shakespeare?
Absolutely. I think the best thing about traveling and seeing world Shakespeare and Shakespeare all over America is that people are constantly reinterpreting the work and constantly bringing in 21st century influences into the work. And certainly the Bard would have approved. Some of the best productions I've seen over the years are plays that are true to Shakespeare's language, yet find wonderfully inventive ways, whether it's Midsummer Night's Dream's young lovers on trampolines, or in the case of a production I saw a couple years ago of Pericles, which I've never enjoyed much until I saw this brilliant production at the Sydney Opera House. And there's this production of Pericles, taiko drummers pounding out the background, the score of every moment of Pericles. Absolutely exciting. And it was just this brilliant combination of martial arts and Asian design and taiko drummers that made Pericles come alive for the very first time for me in an exciting way. A brilliant production by John Bell, who's almost as famous as Shakespeare in his home country of Australia. I've had the great privilege many times of jumping up to Vancouver to watch Bard on the Beach, an unlikely combination of great wonders. But here are these two lovely theaters in circus tents with Shakespeare's classics in the forefront of the tent. But when you look through the scenery and through the characters on stage, the backdrop is, number one, the Pacific Ocean with ships sailing by, giant cruise ships sailing by during the show. Behind the Pacific Ocean is the entire city of Vancouver, which lights up beautifully at night. And then, of course, behind the city are these lovely mountains. And it's one of the most astounding visual sights you'll ever see. You've heard about Shakespeare in Glasgow and Shakespeare in Neuss, Germany, and Shakespeare, not just the United States of America, but all over the world.
Yeah, Neuss was an interesting, I was reading about it in the latest quarto, and it seemed to be focused on new trends, modern trends in Shakespeare.
What they do that's so wonderful is they bring companies from all over the world, from Korea, from Japan, from the Netherlands. They bring companies from all over the world to do Shakespeare in Neuss, Germany. And of course, there are many models of that. I was at Prague Shakespeare Festival this last summer, and there in the middle of the Czech Republic is this lovely, hardworking, ambitious international Shakespeare company made up of acting company members from all over Europe, Russia, America, producing Venus and Adonis, producing Hamlet with an American director and an international cast in Prague. And founded by an American artistic director.
Back to the Shakespeare Theater Association, do you have any goals in the near future, or are you acting as advocates?
What the heck do we do? Well, you know, our stated purpose is basically to provide a forum for the artists, especially the artistic directors, the key staff, artistic directors, managing directors, producers, and the educational leaders, with the idea of gathering them together to discuss the issues involved with producing Shakespeare in the 21st century and the methods of work, the resources, the educational tools that they use from a marketing point of view, from an artistic vision point of view, and to act as an advocate for Shakespeare productions and training throughout the world. I know, for example, I'm doing one session where the question is really, where's the Shakespeare? Meaning that if I go to the largest theater in the Americas, which is the Stratford Festival in Canada, I find that they're doing three musicals last year. There was a time when that would have been considered, you know, the mortal sin of all time for Shakespeare festivals, but not anymore.
Do you think that that is mostly a financial game, or is it something that they're just expanding their interests and there's a limited number of Shakespeare plays?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the truth is it started as a financial and audience growing impetus of opportunities that people saw for engaging younger audience members and, say, a spouse or the children of a group of people who were traveling to what we call destination Shakespeare festivals. Major destination festivals, for example, include Oregon Shakespeare Festival, Utah Shakespeare Festival, the Stratford Festival in Canada, Alabama Shakespeare Festival, the Public Theater's New York Shakespeare Festival, yep, where people come from all 50 states and around the world to see specific productions or to come to see three or four or five productions, and therefore spend their money in restaurants, stay open hotels, and drop a lot of dollars in the community. So when you say, is it financial? It's financial in terms of selling tickets, sure. It's financial in terms of developing extra audiences. Let's say mom wants to see the Shakespeare, but the kids are going to see the musicals. And then they see the Shakespeare, and then they develop a taste for it. Or dad wants to see a not very often done Eugene O'Neill play or Tennessee Williams play. So he'll go along with mom, who's the one who usually buys the tickets, right? It's usually the women of the world who are the ticket purchasers for Shakespeare and on Broadway. And so to have a more diverse schedule of contemporary comedies, dramas, mysteries, and musicals can make sense in terms of developing a broad-based audience. So financial in terms of short-term ticket sales, long-term audience development, but especially economic impact in keeping people in your city for 3, 4, 5, or 6, 7 days at a time.
As an actor, I have to say that I'm a fan of anything that brings more work to actors in any any genre.
We have a lot of oddities out there. We have a special section in Quarto that we call Weird William. And the truth is, a lot of my colleagues around the world, they write me and they say, please don't put us in Weird William. I say no promises. But, you know, when you're producing work like Twelfth Dog Night, A Midsummer Saturday Night's Fever Dream, Comedy of Aerosmith, or my favorite is Hamlet, the artist formerly known as Prince of Denver. You deserve to be in Weird William. And when you're doing, on, you know, Saturday between shows, you're doing barbecues.
Oh, my gosh.
Then, yeah, you know, you get what you deserve.
I must say that some of those titles are very familiar to me. You're referencing productions that have been staged by the famous troubadours of Los Angeles.
Absolutely. I love those guys. A lot of great shows they've produced over the years, but they've attracted a new audience. And I'm with you. Anything that provides new work for actors and for directors and musicians, fabulous.
Absolutely.
Yeah, one of our more recent interviews was with a group here in New York who decided to stage the SparkNotes version of Richard III.
But I hadn't heard about that. You've got to send that to me.
Their whole goal, as stated, was to grow Shakespeare's audience and introduce Shakespeare in a more, what they said, way that would attract more of the younger people to, because they would be able to understand.
Well, it's not just SparkNotes and the Troubadours. I mean, there's God Save Gertrude, a punk rock musical that was done in Boston Court Theater in California, A Midsummer Night's Dream with pirate booty and bodacious babes on a pirate ship in Las Vegas. Richard III is a Vegas lounge singer in a Houston, Texas, War of the Roses cycle. And I don't know, do you know about Rose Rage?
Yes. Wasn't that recently produced at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival?
Oh, it was originally produced in the West End in London. And it's just this brilliant, you know, mashup of the War of the Roses, but with butchers. It was like the taiko drum Pericles, except you had butchers surrounding the action in their white butcher and, you know, big white hats and all that stuff. And they're chasing pig guts splattering everywhere during the production. And they're underscoring the show with, you know, with the...
Chop, 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 chop,
you know, and so, you know, when Richard III is in a romantic scene and trying to woo Elizabeth, It's a more melodic. And then when he's, you know, ready to kill the princes, it's explosive. Very, very funny.
It sounds like there's an endless well of creativity that Shakespeare and his works continue to inspire.
A lot of silliness, but also a lot of very profound work. I don't know if you're familiar with Shakespeare Behind Bars, the wonderful Shakespeare in Prison project that Kurt Toffland put together when he was artistic director at Kentucky Shakespeare and is now, you know, taking around the world as a guest speaker and as a promoter of this phenomenal effort of Shakespeare in the justice system.
You highlighted Shakespeare, the San Quentin Project, in your recent Quarto. And why do you think Shakespeare is so successful with prisoners?
You know, I think they see the big picture. I would imagine, and I've read the accounts, and I've seen Kurt's movie, of course, Shakespeare Behind Bars, that won so many awards. But they talk about the profound nature of Shakespeare's words resonating with their experience in a very isolated prison situation, and where you have so much time on your hands and where your mind is basically your only friend and your best friend. And so, you know, contemplating Hamlet's speeches or Macbeth's soliloquies or the comedic dark humor of Richard, of all the Richards, it resonates with them in terms of life and death struggles and in terms of the afterlife in a way that no other author has. And I think discovering that with a good coach, a good Shakespeare coach like Kurt Toflin, also empowers them when they understand those words and they can explain those words to fellow prisoners and to their friends and family. So I think that's part of it all.
Yeah, one of the things I love about it is that under normal circumstances, the people that are being exposed to Shakespeare would never even think about it.
Right. It hit a lot of us by surprise at the rapidity of the growth. I mean, the Actors Shakespeare Project in Boston has done remarkable things with this. Shakespeare and Company in Lenox, Massachusetts, and San Francisco Shakespeare Company have all put together these remarkable programs that include outreach and bringing people not just into the shows, but putting actors into schools. And San Francisco Shakespeare runs a midnight Shakespeare basketball league, you know, so they basically take the kids off the street at midnight and involve them in these Shakespeare exercises and productions and basketball. And so they do midnight Shakespeare all the time. It's an amazing program.
For theater artists who'd like to bring this sort of advocacy to their community, what resources are available to them? If I were inspired by this and wanted to do it in my community, I wouldn't know where to begin.
I know. You know, having met so many of the founders of Shakespeare festivals and listen to their stories that are so diverse and listen to their community stories that are fairly phenomenal. I mean, Oregon and Stratford, for example, the two largest Shakespeare festivals in America, if not the world, you know, both come from communities that were failing. In Oregon's case, where they had cut down all the timber, and they were a timber town, a logging town, and they chopped down all the trees, basically. And so they had to find something new to do. And this guy, Angus Bomer, says, well, how about if the city loan, you know, gives me $500 to build a stage for a Shakespeare festival? And they all laugh at him. But behind closed doors, they say, let's give him $500 to build a stage for this Shakespeare-y guy. And then we'll strike a deal where we can use it at night for boxing matches. And to everybody's surprise, the Shakespeare productions outdrew the boxing matches in the very first year. A similar story in Stratford, Canada, you know, where, again, the city was down and out. And, you know, they had to find something new. So the community really got together and said, let's put together this festival and reach out to some of the best people in the world. Those are kind of, you know, the big stories. The little stories of the other 220-some Shakespeare festivals in America are just people like you and me who say, gosh, I really believe in Shakespeare and I'm an actor and gosh, nobody's hiring me right now. Or I'm a director and nobody, you know, I'm 26 years old and nobody's hiring me to direct Shakespeare. The only way I'm going to get to do this for a living or for to do the major things I want to do, the major roles or direct the major productions, is to start a festival myself. And that's how most of our festivals got going. And a lot of times people used out-of-use high school auditoriums or outside pseudo-Roman amphitheaters, you know, they're built around the United States, and just found, they found spaces. And then year by year, it grew. And that's really the story of over 200 Shakespeare festivals in America. Now, to answer your question, there are some great books. Not to be self-serving, but How to Run a Theater is one of those books. And mine's not the only other book. There aren't a lot, you know, because people are so busy running theaters that very few have time to sit down and write a book about it. But there are half a dozen books on Amazon.com about starting your own theater company and incorporating your theater company and those kinds of things.
You occupy a pretty interesting place in theater, which is you straddle the academic and the professional worlds. And one of the things you hear so many actors say is that I had to unlearn everything I learned in acting school. What do you think that's all about?
Well, I guess it depends what acting school they went to.
Right, there you go.
But the truth is, even in America, it's kind of surprising that many acting teachers throughout America believe that Shakespeare is the core acting teacher. You know, that if you can do Shakespeare, if you understand how to scan a line, you understand iambic pentameter, and you can make it work for you, and you can analyze and research the heart of the history of what's behind these plays, and you develop the tools to the point where you can master Shakespeare as an actor, then everything else is easy. If you're not speaking in verse, all of a sudden, contemporary plays are a piece of cake. You know, wrapping your mouth around words that are written in our own vernacular is easy. You know, if you can research the War of the Roses and make sense out of it and understand all of Shakespeare's double entendres and, you know, his brilliant use of assonance and alliteration and how he makes things pop on stage, then, of course, you know, looking at more contemporary playwrights and analyzing their work and making that come alive on stage is much simpler.
So, certainly your instrument has to be at top form to perform Shakespeare.
Thank you for that. You know, I cut my teeth in outdoor Shakespeares. And one of my first experiences was in Yellow Springs, Ohio, at an outdoor theater in the middle of the Antioch University campus, where Arthur Lithgow, the father of John Lithgow, the Broadway actor and famous movie actor, his father was a great Shakespearean and was most likely the first person to ever complete the entire Shakespearean canon in America. That outdoor experience that I had at Antioch Shakespeare Festival and then later at Colorado Shakespeare Festival, where you have 1,000 hard rock, literally rock seats, as it was built, the Mary Rippon Theater was built during the WPA administration by WPA workers who basically carved the rocks out for the seats of the theater. As an actor, you better be able to hit the back of that 1,000-seat auditorium. That actor needs to have a well-developed instrument, both in terms of the physicality of gesture and certainly the vocal strength and power and diversity to carry Shakespeare's work in that kind of setting. And that's true for Spring Green, Wisconsin, the American Players Theater, and the dozens of other outdoor theaters, and the hundreds of other theaters around America that are larger. Very few small Shakespeare festivals. It's always a good idea to have, you know, more people in the audience than you have on stage.
Yes, that's always a good working thesis to start a Shakespeare festival on.
Jim Volz, have you seen a production at the Theatricum Botanicum in Topanga, California? Recently,
I have. I love Ellen Geer and going way back to Will Geer and family. These are Shakespeareans, you know, who understand the tradition, who understand the spoken word, and who understand how to simply deliver great Shakespeare productions. And it goes back to your early questions about why do so many people feel that they have to unlearn what they learned in school? And it's because there are too many MFA programs and, quote, professional training programs and undergraduate teachers around America who really don't have practical Shakespeare training. They have Shakespeare training out of a book, or they have Shakespeare training with a poor teacher who doesn't understand how Shakespeare works and hasn't seen a lot of the work in professional production, and teach bad habits to actors. So it's great. I advise any wannabe Shakespearean actor, or even any actor at the beginning of their career. And I know actors who now have been doing this for 30, 40, 50 years, who still sit in rehearsals with other great actors and listen to every word and ponder every word and continue to learn. And these are actors in their 50s, 60s, and 70s who continue to embrace the training and the learning from great actors on stage. That's great Shakespearean training.
Jim Volz, thank you so much for being our guest on The State of Shakespeare.
Really enjoyed this time. It's amazing how an hour goes by, but Jim and Garrett, you guys are great hosts, and thanks for letting me spend time with you today. A real privilege.
Thanks for joining us, Jim.
All the best. Talk to you someday when our paths cross in person, okay?
Cheers. I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And I'm Jim Elliott.
And thank you for joining us on The State of Shakespeare.
Thanks for joining us for the State of Shakespeare podcast. We invite you to visit stateofshakespeare.com for more episodes, information about each of our guests, and the Shakespeare text you heard on the program, and much more. And we welcome you to join the discussion by liking us on Facebook. That's www.stateofshakespeare.com. Thanks for listening.